Hey, White Sox fans, it is Believe in White Sox, podcast number 7. And again, this is 7 in a row. Tommy Barbie, my co-host, he joins me. Hey, welcome to Lucky Number 7, Tommy.
Happy to be on board.
All right, well, it is sort of a happy number 7 because the White Sox, hey, they're good again or something. I guess the Minnesota Twins will cure what ails you after a pretty flat start to the last homestand before the All-Star break. And really, if we extend it even back to Pittsburgh, where they could only split, sort of a flat team, maybe understandably so, because the offense has got like AAA guys and AA guys and a couple major leaguers, and a couple major leaguers are not hitting like the major leaguers they are. And they managed to really take the Minnesota Twins out to the shed and take 3. It would have been 4. Rain saved them from 1, I think. But 3 straight games and some momentum going into a long yet sort of cream puffy road series before the All-Star break.
Absolutely. You know, the offense came alive. The Sox are hitting homers again. And, you know, things are looking up.
Checking in on the team, as it seems like we do each time, or I do because I'm a nerd or whatever. 14.5 ahead of the Twins. 4.5, I think, up on Cleveland. Cleveland's doing the best they can to sort of give us an additional first place pad. But yeah, just sort of be the only other team in the AL Central. We got a magic number of 80, Tommy. Run differential is up to 95, which makes them 4th in baseball, 2nd in the American League. And if you correlate that to what they project record-wise for the season at that run differential rate, they are going to be 101 win team, slightly more wins than both of us predicted them for them before the season. But even if you just take the straight winning percentage, knowing that Tony La Russa is going to screw a few games up, that's a 97 win pace they're on right now. Yes. It is important that they, eat up all they can from this delicious buffet that is laid out for them before the All-Star break, which includes Detroit Tigers, more Minnesota Twins, and then just for kicks, Baltimore Orioles. We feeling good about how they are going to play into the All-Star break, Tommy?
It's hard not to. I mean, really, after Donaldson kind of did his little antics, the Sox definitely wanted to make sure they finished off the Twins, and I think they'll maintain that same edge throughout the rest of the series leading up to the All-Star break. So I look for more good things from them.
Yeah, nothing sums up the week for the Twins or for this Twins White Sox rivalry than the Twins, I believe. Yeah, it would have been the second game. Immediately starting to crow about Josh Donaldson and Homer, and then like mere innings later, like doing all the frowny, like, you know, whatever memes or something, you know, like make it end or whatever. I mean, in the course of just mere innings, I mean, this is really not that it's important that you put necessarily stick the sword through the Twins' heart, because they had already done a good job of that themselves. But exactly. I mean, this really does whatever season they thought they were going to have winning, like 2 out of 3 games the rest of the season just to get to 90 wins, their season's dead.
Yeah. And I mean, it was kind of satisfying in a way, because the White Sox have a nasty habit of letting teams just kind of linger and hang around. And this was, you know, just the pure, they ended them. I mean, by the end of it, the Twins players looked absolutely dejected. And I think that's the kind of killer instinct that if the Sox are supposed to be this deep run playoff team, these are the things that you want to see throughout the season.
And now we have to worry about the third place Tigers. The third place Tigers are in better shape than Minnesota.
Absolutely.
You know, they're healthier or whatever. So now that's the team we got to worry about. Wait, let's not even talk about Detroit. Let's talk about the Kansas City Royals. Kansas City's lost like 50 games in a row. I mean, this team was supposed to be a little more competitive, and the White Sox second half schedule does feature plenty of Kansas City, is getting a little less daunting by the fact that they are completely inept. What has happened to the Kansas City Royals?
Kansas City can't buy a win. I mean, it's weird to say, but the team that honestly I think could give the Sox most trouble are the Tigers. And I just think that the Tigers being a younger team, being a hungrier team, is kind of, they're still trending upwards. So, I mean, I could see them giving the Sox a much harder time than teams like the Royals, and even to a certain degree, a team like the Indians, who they just can't stay healthy.
Yeah. The Royals got a little bit of that, like Todd Frazier, Robertson, that like era, was that 2016, whatever that was, White Sox, where it's like they weren't really sure where they wanted to go. Detroit's sort of still all in with like, well, we're just going to, whoever these guys are, we're going to play with them and see what happens. And that does make them more dangerous, because you figure, okay, well, Carlos Santana, he may have just 1.5 legs by the end of the season. Or, you know, the fact that Kansas City sort of dipped there, I mean, you know, kudos for going for it, but through the first half, not looking like it's working out. So you're right. Really, maybe even more so than Cleveland, depending, I guess, on how healthy Cleveland gets. Detroit might be the biggest pest. So let's squash them over the weekends in case they get any illusions of actually competing for this division. The White Sox, of course, as we've checked in pretty much every time we've done one of these podcasts, in great shape, of course, because all these projected, number, I mean, they could project 85 wins, but if they're 20, I mean, right now they're projecting to win the division by 21 games. That's a nice pad. Now, granted, that's a projection. Who cares? They're only up, 4 or 5 games right now, but it's nice to know that no other team in the AL Central has a positive run differential.
Really comes close. Exactly.
I mean, you're like, oh no, who's going to play third base if Mankata's out, or who's going to play right field because Adam Eaton's out? But I mean, at this point, I'm not going to say the Charlotte Knights can do well in this division, but right now, the Charlotte Knights with this pitching staff can probably win this division. And right now, they sort of are. So, I mean, we're seeing it play out in real time that this is a half night's lineup. So it's actually
scary happening. To say that, isn't it? Yeah. Either Charlotte Knights or DFA castoffs from teams like the Pirates.
Cleveland is going to lament 3 days into spring training, cutting Billy Hamilton loose. I tell you, they're like, all he needed to do was only hit right-handed. Wow. Okay, let's talk about maybe some Charlotte Knights, because we had one come up over this past series in Gavin Sheets, and he really did about as well as you could expect a guy coming up and finally actually getting to play. His second stint with White Sox, his first time actually playing, he just mashed hell out of the ball.
He really did. I mean, just every at-bat was coming in with really good intentions. Like, you could see his thought process throughout the at-bat. And a lot of times, especially, first time up in the majors, you see guys kind of guess or try to figure out, oh, I should look over here for a pitch, or I should look here. He had a process that he just went through each and every at-bat and executed. And the thing that impressed me most was that he really didn't try to pull anything. He was just taking whatever was coming his way. So if it was a ball he could pull, he absolutely would mash it to, and pull side. But if it was something that was further away or, harder that he couldn't get around on, he had no problems just kind of shooting it down to the, corner outfield. And it's like, that's really all you could ever ask for from a hitter.
Yeah, he's not scared of it. He's not scared of the major league's dead ball. He played in Birmingham. 2019. He's like, I've played in the dead ball era. I hit home runs in the dead ball era. They kept me in the organization. All right, let's skip ahead to, the development that came out of the game today, recording on Thursday day game. And that is Mankata injuring himself. Yet another White Sox player injuring themselves sliding. I guess you have to injure yourself doing something. It's better than opening bottles of water or whatever some of the other more or Chris Sale jumping out of a truck whatever that is. Mankata hurt. It seems like he's definitely out at least this weekend's series at Detroit. May or may not be on the injured list. Seems like it's plausible a player will be called up from Charlotte. It seems most logical it's either Jake Berger, first rounder, who's played all of 2 months, essentially almost 2 months professionally. It's basically right. Almost that. Or Tim Beckham, who is certainly more of a veteran MLB player, less upside there, but has also mashed very well in Charlotte. So you cannot fault either one of these guys for being the two hitters who have put themselves in position to get called up. In your eyes, what's the smarter call-up? Let's just presume for these 9 games to the All-Star break, and then maybe the player doesn't even stick with the Sox.
Yeah, I mean, for me, bringing Berger up is a low risk move where you get an opportunity to see what he has. You can showcase him for other teams that might be interested. And, you know, his defense may not be great, but I don't think he's any worse than Beckham is. So, I mean, I don't know that that's a huge downside necessarily either from that aspect. So I think in the spirit of the youth movement that the White Sox suddenly find themselves in mid July, which is not ideal for this type of team, it is perfectly in line with some of the other moves that the Sox have made recently.
Yeah. People have been complaining, and probably with merit, Yoan Moncada's defense has been sluggish, maybe over the past couple weeks at least. But you know, if it's Jake Berger or maybe even Tim Beckham, it might be like, well, you know, you don't know what you have till it's gone.
Don't because
you know, the funny thing is, you know, the Knights have sent out several really great highlights of Berger. He can make plays. It's just, yeah. I think a lot like with a lot of guys, like with Tim Anderson, sometimes it's just the routine plays or routine throws that you're not done well. And that's not Tim Anderson this year, but certainly as a young player growing into being a major league shortstop has had some of those, you know, those types of gaffes. So, you know, I guess hopefully if nothing else, you know, you're backing off set it and you're going to get plus production from other places, like, you know, like, oh, I don't know, like Gavin Sheets, you know, the rest of the youth movement. But really, actually, the sneak move that the White Sox might do is Blake Rutherford. He might be the third baseman. He might just get the call up. Not doing very well. Why not? You know, the team's high on them. You know, okay, why not?
Throw him out there.
Yeah, so sure, you know. Because we couldn't have him play outfield, you know, right?
No.
An outfielder
play
outfield.
That's too easy. Yeah.
My goodness. Okay, well, you know, things are riding really high with the White Sox. I'm sure we'll be checking in at least once more on the Believe in White Sox podcast before the All-Star break, because there's going to be great stuff to talk about. They're going to win probably 6, 7, 8, 9 more games before the All-Star break. And we're going to want to catch the wave and jump in on that and talk about it and giggle more and laugh at the Twins some more and all that stuff. Let's briefly take a spin around baseball. Of course, the big, ugly, abusive, nasty, smarmy elephant in the room is Trevor Bauer's missteps, continued missteps. And I think, you know, there's no question Trevor Bauer's a jagoff. We knew that a long time ago. So, I mean, there's probably not a lot of debate there. I think maybe an interesting thing to talk about is how the Dodgers have handled this so far. It seems like nothing has been done by the Dodgers. And I understand the teams sometimes are a little handcuffed by what they, well, bad choice of words there, but can be limited by what they do based on what Players Association can push back on. And so maybe with a little sympathy to what the Dodgers can even be in position to do, still in all, this is not looking really good for the Dodgers, especially given the year that have led up to this, because they've had similar types of situations and they've failed them as well.
Yeah, and I also wouldn't let Major League Baseball off the hook either, because, I mean, there were a slew of front office sexual harassment issues going into the season, and I think just recently, like, the final personnel that have been publicly outed for being a part of it finally got fired, and it's just like, it shouldn't take holding your feet to the fire to at least suspend Bauer or any of these guys and just say, you know what, we understand, you know, that you have to go through the process, all that, but you gotta sit. Like, there's no reason. People have been benched for far less, and it's ridiculous to me, even from a potential grievance standpoint, that's the line that both Major League Baseball is walking, as well as the Dodgers organization.
Yeah, I mean, at some point, you just gotta do the right thing, and if you end up getting hammered somehow, right? I mean, okay, maybe just take that. I mean, how is the public not going to be on your side for taking? I mean, granted, they're probably not going to be on your side in the first place for signing the jerk in the first place. But okay, right. Past that, you can still do something here. And I mean, they were tweeting out, but just this morning they were sending out something about voting black and blue, some like association with the White Sox. You were tied into the White Sox, you know, it's the whole Camelback connection.
Yeah,
you know, and I mean, okay, what are you going to do? Probably, but got to take that stuff down. That stuff can't be allowed to surface. And yet they do. Yeah. There's like, wait, they got billions of dollars in that organization. It just seems like a lot of stuff slips through the cracks. And, you know, I guess say Dave Roberts, you know, not a good look there either, acting like he's somehow handcuffed when I believe just tonight's game, they were making late last minute switches to the lineup. So it's like, wow, this,
But I mean, it just, I think to put a finer point on it, it's like for years, everyone has been saying exactly what Trevor Bauer is. And for years, those voices have been squashed or been given anecdotes of why that's not true. And he's been increasingly dangerous in a public way over the course of many, many years. And nobody's done anything about it because he can throw a ball. And it's like, you have to do the right thing, and it shouldn't be so hard to do. You know, it's the same thing that Aroldis Chapman never really faced any consequences for his actions. And it's like, there are the guys that people decide to go after, the guys that MLB decides to go after, the inconsequential guys that are fringe players or relievers that are having one good year. And then, you know, it's like, okay, we'll suspend you for the rest of the season and you don't have to worry about it. But if you really believe in the empowerment of women, if you really believe in making sure that you are truly a partner in equality and equity, this is the stuff that you have to get right. And it's really just shocking and sad on so many levels that the easiest thing in the world that both baseball and the Dodgers could do, they're refusing to do.
And you know, again, apples to oranges, but Hector Santiago is going to be sitting for 10 games and not be paid. And and apparently Trevor Bauer still in line to make his start Sunday. Of course, it's a podcast for another day, but I feel somewhat vindicated. This is the debate that I had, well, not this specifically, but it was Trevor Bauer debate with my friend, I think, Steve Stone, and got blocked over because I brought race into the fact that people might treat Trevor Bauer differently than they might treat like Marcus Stroman. And let's face it, Marcus Stroman hasn't done, I'm not sure anything, but he certainly hasn't
anything
near what Trevor Bauer has done in his life. Anyway, and this was before what we've just learned about Trevor Bauer. So let's move on to Trevor Bauer, because that is, I'm going to take a pause here and just wash my mouth out here for just a second because it's necessary. I mean, and again, this is talking about Trevor Bauer before anything was learned a day or two ago.
Oh, yeah.
But now it's worse. And, you know, hopefully this is a guy who might just go away from baseball. I mean, there's definitely no good outcome from this, but at this point, given what has happened, the good outcome is maybe not having to see this guy again.
Yeah.
It's a distinct possibility. All right. With that as a key segue, again, terrific co-host here for you, Tommy, segging now into some maybe perhaps lighter topics. Let's get into some bonus categories. Let's not talk about the 2020 White Sox, although it is fun. We should just be talking for hours about them, because this stretch is a real fun time to talk for a couple hours about them. But we do not want to disappoint the tens of thousands of Believe in White Sox listeners out there. So let's get into some fun stuff. I want to know if you have 5, if you have 3, if you have 10, if you have a whole lineup, if you have a rotation. I want to know your favorite all-time White Sox players. And I'm not talking about like all-time like Ed Walsh, because why wouldn't Ed Walsh be a favorite player? He was a monster. He's a workhorse. But we never saw him play. So we're talking about guys we saw play, got pretty close to our era of seeing players.
Yeah. My 5 would be, I don't know if this will be a surprise or not, but my 5 would be, I would start with Carlton Fisk.
Ooh, okay.
'Cause he was my first favorite.
Wow.
Because he really made an impression on me just from such a young age, because like I knew abstractly that he had been around for a while, but I didn't realize like how high level he played at such an advanced age at catcher your career's usually shot after 10 years. And so just always thought the world of him for that reason, and for, you know, just the grit that he showed for the entire career that he had with the White Sox.
Yeah, he was a machine. And, you know, let's face it, Tom, you're a cranky guy, so you appreciated the crankiness of a Carlton Fisk.
You know, it's I felt the connection.
All right, well, because you revealed your first favorite, I'll cut in and just throw my first out, and that's Chet Lemon. Chet Lemon was my my very, very favorite. Loved him. The fact that I even got to interview him a couple times, got to meet him, talk to him, tell him what he meant to me as a young White Sox fan is a nice little bonus. Two, got to tease him about the fact that even though he was considered such a gold glove level, even though he did never win a gold glove, certainly not with the White Sox, he'd catch the ball at his shoulder. And me and my dad used to play catch that way. And sort of, he used to say, Brett, this is what you don't do, but let's have fun with it. This is what we don't do. Anyway, yes, that was my equivalent to Carlton Fisk. But please give me the rest of your lineup.
No, that's a great pick. My second is also early 90s, Jack McDowell. I apparently have a thing for surly White Sox players.
Yeah, really, you cornered the market.
But yeah, I mean, also just, I don't think it, history's been interesting because it's like, as dominant as he was, I think now people don't realize not just how good he was, but how good most of those pitchers were. Like, you're talking about McDowell, Fernandez, like they were so good. And it's just not something we talk about or celebrate a lot. So McDowell's the other. Frank Thomas, of course, you know, is a given. I just always, I think the thing I appreciated the most about his game and watching him play is that you see this like just massive hulk of a man on TV, but he was such a smart hitter and never just like outright mashed the ball. And I always, especially once the steroid era became like this larger than life thing, always felt kind of bad for him because it was just like you saw, I remember watching Barry Bonds at that peak and Sammy Sosa, and watching them play, it was kind of like watching, you know, somebody beat a three-year-old in a video game. Like, it just never looked fair. But then you watch Frank Thomas and it's like, no, he's actually taking an approach to the game and respects the craft of the game. And it was just always at a different level for me.
Yeah, he wouldn't chase. And that discipline you can really appreciate because he could kill the ball, he could hurt you with the ball, but then he wouldn't compromise. And there's I'd say there's something to that. Yeah.
And I mean, all the way through his career, he always approached it that way. And it's just like there's so many other guys that would have taken shortcuts, not just in terms of performance enhancing drugs, but even just turning into a pull hitter just so you could hit more home runs. And that's not something that he ever did. The last two for me, first one is Maglio Ordóñez, who I know Ozzie Guillen hated with the passion for good reason, but just the sheer numbers that he put up, like there's a good run in him where it was just like these insane numbers, and I was convinced that he was just going to, you know, go on and have this monster career. And of course injuries kind of derailed that, but he always, you know, even I think as I remember watching him as a rookie, it was like the first week that he got called up, and just the way that he played the game, I was like, there's something really special here. And just watching him develop and flourish in that way was really cool.
Even in a truncated career, I mean, he qualifies as one of the best White Sox outfielders,
White Sox players.
That speaks to, you know, maybe their prowess in the outfield. But I mean, yeah, hats off to him for sure.
Yeah. And then last but not least for me, and this one is somebody I met at Sox Fest, so I like that adds to the experience, but it's actually Ray Durham.
And Ray Durham's another guy
that I just thought was not only cool, but like so damn good and talented, and never got credit for it. And he didn't have like the oversized personality of some of the other guys that he played with, so I think, you know, that was part of it, but always seemed like a guy that was a little bit ahead of his time in terms of what he brought to the table and what he was appreciated for.
Oh, loved Ray Durham. I was wondering if we'd have any overlap. I mean, we're not that much older than you, Tommy. Come on. Yes, Ray was. He's always the first guy after Chet for me. The smile, that you know, he had, the effervescent play, sneaky value, sneaky high value.
Yeah.
Some sneaky great seasons for sure. For me, I'll pick another guy very similar, just because I always loved him before he came to the White Sox. When we came to the White Sox, this is the first time I think I remember a trade where I was like, oh my God, they got like one of my favorite guys, Tim Raines. Getting Tim Raines was like, you know, granted, he was already maybe lost a half step, although maybe not initially, but it was a vindication. I sort of felt like the White Sox were like a real team. That maybe was the first trade where I thought, man, they're a real team.
Yeah,
so they're really like competing on a different level. I know when Reinsdorf came in and signed Carlton Fisk after they already signed like eight catchers that offseason before they took over, was sort of a little bit of indication there too. And they made some trades to indicate that as well. But that's the one that I thought, wow, that's a blockbuster. This is like a top,
right over the top,
top guy in the majors.
So
I'd loved having him just as a favorite guy. AJ Pierzynski. I liked just his don't give a damn attitude. And you know, he was so there's you surly. Reflecting my win at all costs attitude about the game of baseball. Yeah, AJ, I loved. I always thought was underrated leader, even. I don't think he might agree with me, but no, I thought underrated leader. Even he wouldn't. I would talk him up. You know, I was lucky enough to cover the team for a couple of years and got to talk to him. And, you know, I would say things like that to him. And even, you know, I mean, of course, you could have false modesty and be like, oh, yeah, I should be the captain of this team or whatever. But, yeah, I don't think he necessarily bought into it either. And, you know, I think you see him as a broadcaster, and I could see him having maybe with a little distance from the game, being able to play that kind of role. I think he might be a pretty good leader. But then I thought that of Carlton Fisk too, and I don't think anybody is lining up ever to hire him as a manager. I guess I had to. I sort of initially forgot about Tim Raines, so I'm cheating. And of course, Frank Thomas sort of has to be on there. I see too much of the eugenics Frank Thomas now to like. It does sort of color me. I'm sorry, and I apologize. Big hurt, but you know, I saw Inouye as that guy who's sort of like his post-career wrestling career. And it does somehow, it confuses me a little bit, but of course, come on, Frank, you can't not have Frank Thomas on your list.
Exactly.
But the two guys I think I would mention would be, again, another guy I got sort of meet and get to know, just such a sweet, humble guy, and sort of got to cover him during his very brief ascent in the majors, that's Sergio Santos. Such an incredible, fun story of being a shortstop and then converting to a pitcher. Doesn't usually end up working out. And the fact that he even had himself a season and change or a couple seasons and actually getting paid before getting traded. Just a real sweet story. Just such a nice guy. And in a different way, even though I never really got to talk to him, although I did get to approach him in the locker room and tell him that he was my wife's favorite player. And he was very gracious in hearing that. Tadahito Gucci just coming in was out of nowhere. You know, the crazy legend of like, never even seen him play in person and just had seen the tape, desperately needed a second baseman, brought him in. And just the fact that he pretty much just hit the ground running and was a real catalyst for a World Series winning team and a great 2006 White Sox team. He was a big, part of that.
One of my favorite plays I ever got to see in person was the play that he made to end the game.
Oh,
when
he you were was there. Like
almost parallel
when
to
he
the ground.
Face planted. Oh my God. Those visuals are extraordinary. I'm sure Cena was like, what just happened? But just when you see the freeze frame where his head is, I mean, that's not natural. That's all out.
Not at all. Yeah.
That's all out. Yeah. And for Japanese players who probably have the reputation of being, not being the Pete Roses of the world, let's say, for being the very analytical and super intellectual, in addition to being brilliant, like Ichiro's, just to see him lay out like that. Sweet. Yeah. Oh man, you were there for that game. Maybe I was too. I don't remember. I don't think so, though. Wow. It seems like every important game we were friends before we ever knew it. All right. Well, that is an excellent 10 or 12 or 15 or whatever we came up with. It's interesting to me that you'd think the 83 team was the one that just, you know, stole my heart, broke my heart, of course. And I, you know, I was struggling. I'm thinking like, who would be there from the 83 team? And nobody really jumped out. I did love Carlton. But nobody really, it's not like, maybe they're just all sort of as a collective, just like, okay, they were there.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course they, you know, did ultimately fail. Thank you, Tito Landrum. And so, I mean, that, you know, that heartbreaking, that's like the 1983 team's eugenics for me. So maybe there's a little taint there. And then even the early 90s, you've got Blackjack, and I love Blackjack too, but nobody really, I mean, you know, the core guys, I guess I did get Reigns on there. So, all right. Early 90s represent, not the early 80s, but I'm sure we'll circle back and we'll come up with some other version of this. Okay. Now let's talk a little music, because I like talking music with you. The question I asked you, and I'm not sure what you came up with. I have three examples, but I want to know you tell me what it is. What did I ask you to do? It was like sort of like a low key hit, a favorite song that I would not predict. From a band?
It's a favorite song by a band that would be considered a curveball. And yeah. I wasn't sure how to consider this, because okay. I could see it where, like, there's two ways of looking at it. And, you know, both are good questions. So it could be both. You know, is it like a band where it's, you know, a B-side that most people wouldn't think of by that band? Or is it like, you know, guilty pleasure, like, even though, you know, we talk about whatever, I secretly love the Eagles in this song.
Right, right. Yeah. I guess my intent was probably something maybe not in the canon or at the top of the canon. I'll give you my example. Maybe this will help flesh it out for you. And one of the three I came up with is Clash. And my choice for my favorite Clash song would be This Is Radio Clash. And granted, that's not like it's not a deep B-side or whatever, but I don't think it's something people would come up with as their favorite Clash song. So that is certainly one of them for me. It's just the song that I fell in love with when I first saw it on MTV before I knew anything about probably punk or what the Clash meant or how much more important they were to sort of the fashion attitude than they even were to the music. And I just loved the song, and I still do. I mean, it'd be different too. Maybe there's a wrinkle to this, is where, like, maybe years ago you thought that and you've since grown out of it or whatever, but that's still probably my favorite Clash song. So that's the example I'm using, if that helps illustrate it any better.
That does.
Okay. So now change your answers.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think... Oh, that's a really good question.
So now I've stumped you.
Because it's like, the way that I think about bands in particular is usually I try to, as best I can, catalog them based on their overall arch of their career and not get so singles heavy, because it's gotcha. Like, especially like, late 80s and early 90s and pop music was a weird time where it was like singles were the thing and people stopped caring about albums as much, and it was just like, all right, here's a single.
right.
And it became like this kind of like monstrous thing, and I think it kind of fettered into the Apple iTunes era where you know, people wanted to do the 99 cent download, but it was like totally left field and not in fitting with like the rest of the music that the band made. You know, all of that being said, here's one that I will say, and I think it's funny because it's a band that I mentioned as being one of the bands that I didn't really care for.
Gotcha.
And yeah, you know, but I will say that as much as U2 rubs me the wrong way, I always thought that Sweetest Thing was just like such the most doe-eyed dopey song, that like it was a perfect 90s song.
Yeah.
And I always embraced it for what it was. And it took me a while to figure out that, like, yeah, that is the exact same U2 that like pretends that they're an arena every time they play music. And yet here's this other song that they did.
Yeah. If I remember correctly, when they repackaged everything for like, they did their greatest hits and then they did like a B-sides along with it, that song did sort of get a little like, sort of like late push.
It was late, yeah.
So exactly. they had their ear to the ground enough to say, hey, people are sort of picking up on this one. Because I do seem to remember that getting a little bit, not certainly that it would mean that should be listed necessarily among the 100 songs you'd first think of associated. So, I mean, that's is exactly the, I guess that's exactly the point of the experiment, I guess, that I'm getting at. So, all right, I will pick a Led Zeppelin song. I don't think it's exactly buried deep, but my favorite Led Zeppelin song is Over the Hills and Far Away, in part because it's one of the first I learned to play, and sort of a real challenge. And just I liked the dynamic of the power, but also the acoustic. And you know, I don't think it's by any means buried. I don't think it's like nobody's heard of it. Of course not. But
no,
as the one that stands out to me as what I would consider my very favorite, without it being some sort of, I'm not going to be too esoteric here at all, but yeah, that's the one that really jumps out at me is the favorite. And I'm doubting that that's necessarily number one for many other people who would be listening. Their very
favorite. And you said you can play it too. Yeah. Can you still play it?
Let's see. Where's the guitar's right there? It has not been bothered for probably a few years now. So I would definitely need. I definitely need to limber up. And you know, the other one that jumps to mind, it's another one, it's probably even a deeper cut, but I always just liked, it's just such just brassy power, just almost like ludicrous in its power, but I always got under my skin. I always loved it was Nobody's Fault But Mine. I just thought it was just just power to me. I mean, I don't know if it was just like, if that's like some sort of like AC/DC precursor or something. It just seemed to be just, we're going to just try to blow up the speakers, and it always just tickled me.
Yeah. But,
all right. So that's my Led Zeppelin foray.
No, that's a good one. And now I know that you play. So, I mean, I just, you know,
learning things all the time.
So, yeah, I mean, I think the only other one that I can really think of, and this might be something that you know or not. I know that on the Killer Bees on the Southside Sox podcast, I do make a lot of Michael McDonald references.
Yes, you do. For our Believe audience, worth going back and listening to. Absolutely. Yes.
But I am genuinely a huge Steely Dan fan. Ooh, and I always have been. And so I think for me, a lot of it would be probably Don't Take Me Alive by Steely Dan.
Okay.
And because the guitar work on it is just insane. Larry Carlton is one of my favorite guitarists. And I just, the fact that Steely Dan basically made a career of being jazz musicians masquerading as rock musicians, masquerading sometimes as pop musicians, and getting away with it for basically their entire career. I just like am mind blown by that.
Yeah. I love that you're picking. I'm being insulting in hopes of getting a laugh, but the idea that you pick something even close to yacht rock is just delightful. And of course it's not. Of course it's not. You know, not in the way that the blue eyed soul of Michael McDonald is. But I mean, you could argue a Simpson fan like that. I mean, that's almost like anything you pick is going to be, could be a surprise to people. Not to say that they're not well known, but they're maybe a couple of the actual radio songs, but then from there, almost anything you can pick and make somebody go, oh yeah,
anything okay, goes.
That's a cool favorite, or that's an interesting favorite. All right, well, my third, I think I've already revealed that Talking Heads are my favorite band of all time, and my favorite song of theirs actually comes from their very last album. It did get considerable play, but that's not usually the order you do it, and it would be Nothing But Flowers, just because it's a great sound, and it, clever, super clever lyric that still makes me sort of laugh when I listen to it. And that's probably a good test, even though it runs a little bit long and the final album itself is certainly bloated. Still probably my very favorite song. And this might be the fact that there are some others that I've heard many more times. So maybe there's just a little bit of ear fatigue there, but really if I had to, whereas there are other bands that are my favorites that I would just pick, like the B-52s, I still will say Rock Lobster is still probably my favorite. Maybe if you're gonna put a gun to my head on Devo, I might say, you know, Whippet's my favorite, sure. But with Talking Heads, yeah, I'm gonna pick I'm gonna sing a Talking Heads song at my wedding, Tommy. So I mean, and I don't even pick that one. So but yeah, that one jumps out at me as just being the most fun. And it's odd that it would be a very, you know, like the very end of their career, probably when they've already decided to hang it up. So
move on. Yeah.
That's the one that jumps out at me as
my third pick was actually David Byrne track. Okay. So it's funny that you went with Talking Heads, and it's the project he did with Brian Eno. And it's the song's called Strange Overtones.
Oh, sure.
And I know that, like, for people that are fans of theirs, gravitated towards that. I'm still surprised to this day that it never made it beyond that in terms of popularity, because there is so much music that I, you know, hearing now and even at the time that it came out, that used a lot of the same kind of sounds and the same production techniques. And you can kind of trace it to that song, and that song is kind of a direct lift, I think, on some of Talking Head's earlier material too. So I've always, just every time I hear that song, I'm just like, okay, I'm in a good place for the next 3 minutes, like, you know, listening to that.
Yeah, that had such a push with the God, what was the movie? Got a lot of play in a movie, but at any rate, I don't know. Interesting. Wow. David Byrne pick.
Yeah,
I remember hearing My Life in the Bush of Ghosts very young and thinking it probably scared me a little bit, actually. It was so weird.
Yeah.
It was so haunting.
It is.
Yeah, it's sort of freaking me out. So, which is a good thing. It's good. It's good to be. There's a few times songs have scared me, and that's a good thing because you don't forget them, you know.
Oh, no. Yeah. I remember the first time I listened to Radiohead's Kid A, and I was like, what the hell happened to the CD?
Yeah, I remember getting scared at Tomorrow Never Knows. That scared me.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially, like, listen to it in the dark. That's good. It really probably shouldn't, but yeah, it spooked me. And I mean, I would think that might have been part of the, maybe part of the intent. So what the
heck? Part of the appeal.
And I was not taking acid at the time. So it probably, probably would have made me more scared, but.
That would have made it more scary. Yeah.
A little too young for that, but all right. Well, I guess that wraps up our musical segment of the podcast and probably does wrap up the podcast, Tommy. No doubt, because there's just going to be good news between here and the All-Star break, because it's just going to be good news. We'll definitely be checking in with a Believe in White Sox podcast. We cannot let down the tens of thousands of listeners out there, including plenty of Barbies. Thank you for standing up, Barbies, man. Core listener, there from the start, some of the first subscribers, Barbie family members. So shout out.
Got them on early. Them.
Thank you. Thank you, Tommy, for doing that. Because you guys led the way. You were the trendsetters. Now the thousands have followed. They've all jumped over the breach behind the core Barbie listeners, the core subscribers. So thank you for that.
Get on the bandwagon.
Thank you for that. All right. Well, from the Eastern time zone, both Tommy and I will bid adieu to our Believe in White Sox audience. Thank you for sticking with us for podcast number 7. Thanks for hopping on once again, Tommy. And let's make it 8 in a row, maybe sometime next week or next week.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody, for listening. Let's keep getting some more wins for the White Sox and send them into the All-Star break. I don't know. Let's say up 10 games. Let's just make this. Let's make the second half a laugher, and let's just have fun. Let's make it like 13 in a row going into the All-Star break. And we'll talk about how great Jake Berger is. Next podcast, Tommy, what do you say?
Sounds good. Hope he gets Homer.
One. Let's go one per game. Come on, Berger time.